So we are going to start with Stefano Caria from the University of Bristol, and then we are going to move to Esther Miriam Giersberger from the University of Technology, Sydney. Please go ahead, Stefano.
Okay, thank you very much. So my name is Stefano Caria. I'm an assistant professor or lecturer, if you're in the UK, at the University of Bristol. And what I'm going to present today is joint work with Girum Abebe at the Policy Studies Institute in Addis Abeba, and Esteban Ortiz Ospina, who is at Oxford and also works for the for Our World in Data. There is a very exciting project distributing descriptive data around big world trends, which you may have seen on Twitter. We are very excited to be able to present our work here, so thanks to the organizer. And now I'll move on because Veronica has a very threatening hammer there. So she made it clear that I have to stick to time. Good. So this is a project about selection, and so it's very nice, in a sense, it's a very nice continuation to the kind of considerations that came out of Bruno's presentation just in the previous session. And I was starting, but this is a project about employers selecting employees, okay? And our starting point really is that successful firms are going to need talented employees, talented workers. There has been a lot of work in the past showing that workers that have different kinds of cognitive and non-cognitive abilities, they're more productive, they are easier to train, they get along with the supervisors. These are the kind of workers you'd like to hire if you're an employer. Now, hiring a productive worker should actually be unproblematic for a firm in a competitive labor market. The only thing that you need to do would be to post a competitive wage, and at that wage you should be able to hire as many workers as you'd like for the required level of skills. But the labor markets where firms typically do their hiring can differ in quite a stark way from this competitive benchmark because they can be characterized by a number of frictions. In particular, in this paper, we're going to zoom in on a specific type of friction, which is job application costs. The time and money that job seekers need to invest in order to complete the application process at a formal firm. This is going to be in Addis Abeba, Ethiopia, where in-person job applications are the norm. So if you want to apply for a formal job, what you need to do is, as a job seeker, travel through a congested city center to meet the employer to deposit the application materials in the first place. And then, is this better? Maybe I should just keep it closer to my mouth. I don't know what the optimal... Okay. So you're going to have to travel through this congested city center to deposit your application materials, then travel again to take tests and interviews and so on. Each of these trips is going to cost money to pay for public transport and time, which in this particular case is actually still very valuable, even if many of the people in our study are going to be unemployed in the sense that they don't have a formal job, is valuable because, yes, they don't have a formal job, they are still engaging in the informal economy quite a bit. So there is a bit of a trade-off between engaging in formal job search that is quite time-consuming and making money on the side, engaging in the informal economy. Okay? Now, the existence of this cost, of this job application cost, is this going to be good or bad for the employer? Well, this is theoretically ambiguous. It may be that it's actually good for the employer to have some level of job application costs. Why? Well, because it's going to help them screen out unsuitable applicants, so people who are a poor match for the job, then once the position becomes costly, the applicant decides not to apply anymore. So job application costs may help employers actually create more compact but higher quality pools of applicants. But if you have a large enough group of workers in the labor market that are poor, they are very sensitive to job application costs, but they're also high talent, then this can actually be bad for the firm because it's going to prevent them from being able to access talent in a significant segment, an important segment of the labor market. So this is theoretically ambiguous. It really depends on these correlations and on the distribution of talent and sensitivity to job application costs in the population. And given that it's an empirical question, we're going to tackle it with some empirical data. In particular, we're going to have an experiment where the employer that we're going to work with is going to do something that, before you think that relationship can go both ways, sounds a bit counterintuitive. The employer is going to pay people to apply for the positions that they're hiring for. Okay, if you think that application costs are good for the employer, this is crazy. But if you think that application costs can be bad for the employer, well, actually, it could be a good idea. We'll see. Okay, let me give you a bit more details about this experiment. So we are in Addis Abeba, Ethiopia, and we'll be working with clerical positions. So think of data entry operators, junior accountants, positions that require some skills. They're not very high up in the skill distribution, kind of in the middle. What we're going to be able to do with this experiment is observe how the quality, the number, first of all, and then the quality of the people that apply for this clerical position change when the employer does one of two things. One, when the employer offers a $4.5 upfront payment that is conditional on simply showing up at the testing center, depositing your material and taking an initial test. Okay? So this is what we call the application incentive. Just money upfront, just conditional on making the application. How much is $4 in this context? For now, suffices to say that it's going to be about half what we estimate the total cost of making the application to be. Okay, so we kind of half the cost. And secondly, we're going to benchmark this application incentive intervention against a second intervention where the employer does the one thing we know employer can do in order to improve the quality of the people that they hire. They're going to increase the wage, moving from the 35th to the 75th percentile of the wage distribution for similar positions in this market, which is a doubling of the wage. Okay, and the expected, didn't say the expected value of this, if you calculate with discounting, probability of getting the job and so on, is about $100 to the average worker. So we're going to document the reduced form impact of these two interventions, but then we want to know, to learn a little bit more about the structural features of this labor market that may make application incentives effective or not. So we're going to use the exogenous variation that is generated by the experiment in terms of number and quality of applicants to back out the size of application costs that people face, their heterogeneity, and how these correlate with worker quality. That's really the key structural parameter that we're interested in because that's what's going to determine whether we're going to attract better people or not so good people. And finally, by comparing the two interventions, we're also going to be able to get at a structural estimate of credit constraints. Finally, that's the plan, part one, part two, and finally, the third act is a second experiment, where basically we're going to be, after doing all of this, suppose that application incentives were effective, then we would be left with this inconvenient question that we always have in experiment. Well, if this was such a great idea, why have people not taken it up already? Surely other people must have thought about this before. And when the experimenter is confronted with that kind of question, typically the response is, well, perhaps they actually haven't figured it out and they are not aware of the benefits of this kind of interventions. In this context, we're going to be able to actually test that standard experimental response because we're going to interview a sample of managers in firms recruiting for similar position in the same market at the same time. We're going to give them information about these interventions and ask them to forecast the effect of the application incentive. So really, we're going to know whether people know about the returns that they can get or not. Okay? So that's the plan. What do we find? So our main finding is the application incentive is actually quite effective at improving the quality of the pool of applicants. Okay, we're going to measure quality in three ways. We're going to think of cognitive ability, non-cognitive ability, and experience. Non-cognitive ability and experience don't change, they stay put. There is no difference on those two dimensions. But we find treatment effects, significant treatment effects on cognitive ability, which we measure through Raven test, Stroop test, and GPA. The effect is quite uniform. So you observe the effect when you compare the three applicant pools that we selected in the control condition, in the incentive condition, in the high wage condition. You'll see that there is more quality at the mean of that pool, but also at the top and at the bottom. So it's quite a uniform shift. And in fact, we have statistically precise evidence of stochastic dominance. So you attract a pool of candidates that stochastically dominates in terms of cognitive ability, the control pool. The size of the effect is also sizable, large. Okay, so this, for example, the number of top applicants that the employer can attract doubles. And the size of this effect, or the size of these other effects here, is equivalent to that of our benchmark intervention where the employer is doubling the wage. So this employer is attracting, getting a similar increase in applicant quality by offering $4 upfront compared to doubling the wage. And finally, importantly, this effect is going to be driven by groups of workers. For example, people without much experience in the formal labor market, people who currently do not have a stable formal job, and women. So all demographics, they typically struggle to get good jobs in the market. Okay? Suggesting that this is not really working by attracting a group of workers that had better outside options and were almost misallocating their talent. On the contrary, what we are doing is tapping from the pool of talent of a group that is particularly constrained. Now, in terms, that's the reduced form. Then we move on to the structural analysis. I'll talk more in detail about that, but just to give you the headline results, what we're going to be able to see are, first of all, that on average, what we estimate the total cost of the application to be for the average worker is quite large. It's about 13% of one monthly wage. It's also quite heterogeneous. And surprisingly, at least to us, it's strongly positively correlated with ability. I forgot to say also 30 credit constraints are also quite widespread. And then there is this strong positive correlation with ability. Okay? This is not what we expected. What we expected was actually that these two objects would be orthogonal. So up here, what we expected were positive effects at the top of the distribution and negative effects at the bottom. And then we thought, well, we need to be then making a bit of a trade-off here of attracting a pool of applicants with more talent, but also it's a bit more risky because it has more dispersion in quality. But that's not what we found. We found this uniform increase, which is then what in the model drives this positive correlation. Okay? And to explain this positive correlation that we did not expect, we propose a selection story, which we give evidence of in the paper, exploiting this high-frequency survey that we ran with job seekers in Addis around this time, just a year or two before. But it's a very similar population. In this survey, we're going to have information about people's cognitive ability, a Raven test, same measure that we use in this experiment, and also information about how costly they find the job search process, either how far away from the city center they live or how much savings they've got. And what we find in this high-frequency survey, where we track people every 2 weeks, so every 2 weeks we know whether they're working, searching for work, or what they're doing, what we find is that smart poor people search for longer than smart rich people. And as a result, over the course of time, smart poor job seekers become overrepresented in the pool of job seekers. So that in this survey, what you see that if you only look at job seekers, at the beginning of the period, in this cohort, there is a weak, non-significant correlation between being poor and being smart. Nothing, noise. But by the end of the period, there is a strong positive correlation between being poor and being smart, entirely driven by selection. Okay, this is, we document as statistically significant in this with this panel. And so that's really at the heart of why we think this is a good intervention in this context. Employers are exposed to a pool of job seekers where poor smart guys that are very sensitive to the cost of job search are overrepresented.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Can I ask a very simple question in relation to selection? Maybe it's just simply that the rich guys get the job because...
True, that could have been, but it's not consistent with the pattern of heterogeneity that we find. It could have been, so it could have been that what we are doing is attracting people that have a better...
Not in your, let's say, experiment.
Yes.
Let's say in the labor market, I mean, there are few good jobs, and I guess, and the rich guys, and there is evidence with, let's say, in MENA countries, but also in African countries, get, especially if you are talking about, like, public sector jobs.
Sure.
It's like the rich and connected guys get the jobs faster, so it's not that the poor are self-selected into waiting longer. I mean, simply they're not getting the jobs.
I thought it was a criticism. Instead, it's actually exactly what we argue in the paper. Sorry, maybe I didn't explain it clearly. That's exactly the story that we have in mind here. The point is the poor are constrained. They're searching at lower search intensity, so it takes them longer to find jobs. That's why if you live far away from the city center, if you have little savings, then you're constrained. If you have more savings or you live closer to the city center, you search more, you get the jobs, you're out of the pool. So it's not that they are longer because they are lazy or some silly explanation like that. It is about constraint. That's exactly our explanation. Sorry, I didn't understand your
point. Sorry, maybe it's just the selection.
yeah, absolutely. In the paper it's clear, sorry, I didn't make it clear presenting it now. Point taken. Now, this is really a mechanism experiment, in our view, but you can think of it as a policy. And if it's a policy, then you want to calculate the return to this particular policy to the employer. We're going to have to make assumptions. There are costs. You have to pay the incentive. You have to spend more time reviewing applicants because you're getting more applications and so on. We factor in all of these costs. There are benefits. You're attracting better people. We're going to have to make an assumption about the value of this to the firm. Make plausible assumption about all of these, and what you get is an internal rate of return of 11%, higher than market interest rates, higher than the return you get by increasing the wage. So this seems like a very good investment for the firm. So why are employers not doing this? Because they badly underestimate the increasing quality that they can get with these policies. In fact, the average employer intuition is very much like the average economist intuition that decreasing cost is going to worsen quality, not increase quality. So they even get, on average, the direction of the effect wrong. Okay, so that's a preview of the results. So if I then forget to say something, you have the whole summary there. We believe that these results make a number of contributions to the literature. There is now a small but growing literature of experiments trying to manipulate different elements of the hiring process. Typically, existing studies have manipulated the wage, expectations about the wage, future wages, and so on and so forth. And they find that better wages attract better people, with some exceptions like Erica De Serrano's paper. But we're really the first to manipulate direct application cost. Okay, so we're showing that there is a second lever that firms can use in order to manipulate the quality of the pool of applicants that they attract, and that this lever does not work in the way you'd expect it to work. Okay, it's a bit counterintuitive. Secondly, there is a labor literature that is really interested in estimating such frictions in labor markets. Our key contribution here is that we're also going to offer an estimate of the magnitude of this friction, but this estimate is going to be based on exogenous variation, which typically the labor literature cannot use because they're working with observational data. And finally, this idea that there is a large number of constrained but talented applicants suggests that there can be misallocation of talent in this labor market, and this has important policy implications, in particular in the light of whether displacement effects like those that Bruno documented in his famous paper with Esther Duflo completely killed the case for active labor market policies, or whether maybe these policies actually could improve the allocation of talent in the market, even if in terms of number of jobs they're not really adding much to the economy. Okay, so that's how am I doing? Good. Now let me tell you a couple of things about the labor market in Addis Ababa before we jump into the details. Okay, and there are two things I'd like you to keep in mind throughout this presentation that are important to interpret these results. This is a city of about 4, now probably coming to 5 million people, very dynamic, has grown a lot. There are lots of new jobs, lots of migrants, so employment rates have stayed quite constant across time. In this dynamic labor market, fact one, firms actually find it quite hard to find the right workers. So in this second experiment, where we sample recruiters, and we ask them, can you please tell us what is the most important HR problem that your firm is facing? The most common answer is we can find workers with the right skills. This comes before turnover, before poor conduct. Turnover is still very big, so that's the other big thing. Before poor conduct, motivation, absenteeism, and so on and so forth. So selection seemed to be really concern number one in the minds of employers. Now, you may think, well, the problem is that simply there are no workers with talents out there. It's a bad draw. Maybe. But at the same time, fact number two, workers themselves are not making a huge effort to make themselves be spotted by employers, because what we find is that job seekers make a surprisingly small number of job applications. Just to give you a sense, in our control group, an average job seeker makes about 2 job applications per month. And this doesn't really change much, maybe it goes up to 2.5 or so if they are unemployed. So the point is, They are searching for work. They're actually spending, in some cases, many hours looking at job ads, asking around, and so on. But this converts into very, very few job applications. And so this means that it's going to be very hard for them to be selected by the right employers. Okay, I was really struck by these numbers when I saw them in our Ethiopia data. And since I've been always looking at the number of applications whenever I see somebody present this kind of paper. So now in the paper, we have a section at the very end where we actually show that this is very common. So there is data from South Africa, from China, from lots of places that actually shows that active job seekers, yes, they may spend a lot of hours in job search, but they convert this into very few applications. Okay, even on online job boards, actually, which is surprising, maybe suggestive of cost down the line, because in fact the cost of just applying on an online job board is just a click. Maybe you're anticipating cost down the line. But even, say, Arnaud Philippe, who's in Bristol, has a very nice paper on online job boards in France. Even there, the number of job applications that people make, it's very small. And this is the main job board in France, so it's not like something peripheral. Anyways, so very few applications consistent with our story of high costs and credit constraints. Yeah.
Just coming back to the cost down the line, do you have results in, say, retention as well of workers, depending on which entry route they used here?
Do I?
Yeah.
Yes. No. I don't. The way I'm going coming to the design in a second, but so all the statistical analysis is going to be at the level of the applicant, not at the level of the recruit. The recruits are too few in order to make statistical analysis of. The anticipating a few details, the position are 3 months long. And I can tell you of the positions that we had, basically retention rate, we didn't have people dropping. I think one person out of 24 that were hired, but it's just 24. Then for each position, we get 100 applicants, which is why we generate the sample size that you're about to see. So, but all of the analysis is going to be at the level of the applicant, not at the level of the recruit. There is one thing that I can say, it's imperfect, indirect evidence, but the kind of high talent workers that we're recruiting are people that have characteristics that suggest that they are less likely to leave the firm. For example, women, people without previous work experience, and so on. So it is a sample that you'd think you should be able to retain for longer, because it's going to take them longer for them to get a good job offer. But that's completely indirect. I don't have a treatment effect on that. Design. Now, before I jump to the design, let me explain what this picture is. It's kind of intuitive, but it's worth explaining. So this is a job board, and this is one of the two main ways with which jobs are advertised in this market. So it's just a physical board in the center of town. There are a number of them. And what employers do is that they write a short ad that basically says, plumber needed, start August 1st. This is the name of the employer. If you want more information, call this number. Very little information, no information about the wage, very rare to post the wage in advance. And you just read this, maybe here are three positions, there is a plumber, a secretary and whatnot, and if you're interested, you follow up with a phone call. Okay? So what we are going to do with this employer is replicate what they would have done anyways. Okay, so this is all natural as it would have happened in this environment, and the employer is going to advertise this clerical position on those job boards and in the same newspapers. In the ads, job seekers are going to find a number that they can call in order to express their interest and learn more about how to apply for the position. And so whenever people call, they become part of our study, and that's the universe of workers we're going to work with, the people who respond to the ad. Now, the moment you respond to the ad, you're going to be randomly allocated to one of three groups. A control condition with the low wage and no incentive, the incentive condition with the low wage and the incentive, and the high wage condition with no incentive, no money up front, but this higher wage in case you get the job. And then you're going to be told that to apply for this job, you're going to have to show up on the following week, visit our application center and take a test. Okay? And the money in the application incentive group is going to be conditional on showing up with your CV and taking the test. So this is going to give us data at three points in time. When people call, when people respond to the ad, we're going to be able to collect a few variables about them. Okay, so we have some information, but we're restricted. We're restricted by the fact that we're not going to ask any question that an employer would not have asked. So we don't elicit, say, time preferences, that kind of stuff here, because an employer does not ask you typically, you know, would you rather have a bag of rice today or three tomorrow? We're going to ask about gender, education, and work experience, standard employer's question. Now, if then people, and we have only one measure of quality that we observe for everybody, which is GPA, because that would be a common thing to ask. Now, if people then apply, we're going to have very detailed measures about their ability. We're going to have these indices of cognitive ability, non-cognitive ability, and specific job experience. And we're going to have a battery of measures of economic preferences, risk aversion, time preferences, measure with convex time budget sets, sophistication, and so on, social preferences, and so on. So we're going to know a lot about those who apply. And finally, 30 days after the initial phone call, we're going to call back everybody to learn about what other job search they've been doing and some retrospective expectation questions. Okay, so that's the plan. So now, on to the results. And I'm doing, it's not a disaster yet. Good. So first of all, what happens to application rates? 41% of the people that call apply, Okay, and this basically stays constant throughout the course of the experiment, suggesting that there was this position generated quite a bit of interest. By applying, I mean they then later the next week showed up and took basically a whole morning off because they had to come there and take a test. This goes up by 11 percentage points if you offer the application incentive, and by 18 percentage points, or almost 19 percentage points, if you double the wage. Okay, this has large and significant effects. So you're getting about 2/3 of the increase in the number of applicants that you get by doubling the wage by offering this $4 upfront.
So just a clarification, I must have missed it, but the information about the incentive and the wage is given during the first phone call, or?
Yes, yes. So when you call, we first ask you these questions, then explain give you a little bit of information about the position that will include the wage, so you learn about your wage, and will include the application incentive in case you're offered the application incentive, and then we tell you you have to come next week in order to apply.
Could it be interpreted as a signaling of the quality of the firm? So I'm giving you money if you come to apply, and kind of a good firm.
It could. We were very worried about this, and so we measured it. I'm going to park your question for a minute because it's coming. Good. Yeah. Sorry.
It seems that when they go and apply in person, there's a lengthier process than the typical application. Were they aware of that in the first phone call or not? Because if time is one of the major costs, then
it's actually standard. So that would we replicated. It would be very similar in many firms.
So just another question about the signaling. There might be another signaling element going on. So this is a contest in which the cost of making applications is very high. So people make very few applications. In the limit, you can think that everybody makes a small set, a given set of applications. In that case, you don't want to waste applications for jobs in which the probability of being accepted is low. And this is where the wage signal comes in. So if you signal a very high wage, that might be a fantastic job, but your probability of being accepted might be very low. So this may be a signal of job competition, not just how good the job is, which is probably why you find a lot of effect coming from the application subsidy and less than you probably would expect from the wage signal.
I will also park this question until 2 slides okay. time because I'm discussing expectation, but these are all important points. Okay. I'll just keep the suspense on for 2 slides. I'll just finish these results and then I'll come back to expectation. But expectation is going to be key to interpret what is happening. You are absolutely right. So first of all, application rates, we've got them. Now, what about quality? I'm going to now show you just the results for the cognitive ability index, but we've got results for the specific indices for non-cognitive ability and experience where nothing happens, and GPA as well. So this index is just Raven and Stroop. Then we have separate results for GPA. We also have significant results there and significant results for each component. So what I'm going to do here is compare these three pool of applicants, the pool that I've selected in the control group, the pool that I've selected in the incentive group, and the pool that I've selected in the high wage group. We're going to use an OLS model to capture changes at the mean and quantile regression to capture changes at different percentiles of the distribution. In fact, we committed to report changes at these 5 specific percentiles in the pre-analysis plan. So what you can see, I'm going to show you 2 rows at a time because there are several rows. What you can see are a positive coefficient throughout, indicating more quality in the application incentive group, significant at the mean, at the top of the distribution, and at the bottom. Okay? These are not just significant at conventional level. They also pass a test for multiple corrections, comparisons. These are Q values correcting for multiple comparisons, even either within the index, because I'm doing 6 comparison for each index, or across indices, because I'm doing 3 indices of cognitive, non-cognitive, and experience. So these are significant results, no matter how you look at them. And the magnitude of this effect is actually very similar to the magnitude of the effect that you get by increasing the wage. In fact, the two are statistically indistinguishable. Okay? And these effects go all the way to the top. So if you want to... and now, let's just tell you. So if you want to restrict to the top 10 applicants for every position or top 5 applicants for every position, you still find very large coefficients on either the cognitive ability or GPA scores. When you start restricting to just top, I lose significance, but in standard deviation terms, these are fairly large effects. And still, anyways, very large for and significant for GPA. Now, so that's quality going up, okay? Now, do managers know about this? No, they don't. What we did with managers is that we explained to them the design of the experiment, told them this is the Raven test score the people on average had in the control group. This is what the Raven test score the people on average had in the high wage group, so they had a sense of a realistic treatment effect on Raven. And then we asked them to forecast the Raven test score of people that showed up in the application incentive group. Okay? And now I'm doing the difference with the control, so zero would have been a prediction of no change. This is a box plot showing you the forecast, max, mean, interquartile range. That's the mean forecast, okay? And as you can see, the mean forecast is negative, so they expect about a 0.5 point on a Raven test score decrease in quality, where the true effect was about a 1.5 increase in quality. And this is true both if they are forecasting average quality or quality at the top, okay? So they get the direction of these effects wrong. Now, coming on to your stories about, or to the belief stuff, we're going to interpret this in a very simple neoclassical way, thinking about cost and benefit, but a number of other things may have happened. So, for example, you may think, well, what the application incentive does is that it helps people with present bias problems, with self-control problems, commit. Okay, that could be, but we have a test of present bias when people show up, so the prediction should be that you should see a larger share of present bias people among application incentive applicants, and we can rule that out. It goes up by an insignificant 2 percentage points, so there's something there, but that doesn't really seem to be what's driving this. Then you can worry about test effort, okay, because these tests are collected there. First of all, we have effects on GPA, which was determined before the intervention, but we also include a test that requires effort, no ability, and we don't find any differential performance on that test. Then come the belief story, okay? We're very worried about this belief story. So one belief story is that you may be worried that these changes, let's start with this belief story. You may be misinterpreting the offer of this intervention as a signal about either your own quality or the tightness of the market, right? Oh, it must be a very tight market if they're offering money for people to apply for jobs, or I must be very good if they're offering me money just to apply for the position. If that was true, you would expect changes in people's beliefs about the labor market prospects, which we cannot document. We can document them, by the way, for the high wage condition, but not for the application incentive. Secondly, the position story. So you may think this is a particularly nice employer and may be good in ways that are difficult to observe. So we're going to have a battery of questions about hard to observe attributes of the job, holidays, quality of social life with colleagues and so on. No changes here. And then we have one more story, and I'm going to come to your story, which is slightly different, Barbara, but that comes in the next slide. There is one more story that was actually suggested by Imran in a comment that he made when I discussed the design with him originally, which is, well, maybe this is not so Bayesian, and it's just more a behavioral signal or something that kind of makes the position very salient. It shocks you, makes the position very salient in your mind. Okay, so you know, we know that poor people are very stressed; they are overwhelmed by lots of information and they forget to do important stuff. So maybe this is a bit unusual and is helping them remember about completing this important application. Well, if that was true, we know from psychology that people are more likely to remember salient information. So we can test whether in phone call number 2, people are more likely to remember information about the position that we gave them in phone call number 1. Okay, that's a measure of salience. The high wage condition actually changes salience. I offer you a larger wage, you think more about this job, and 1 month later, you are more likely to remember information I've given you about this job. But the application incentive does not do it, which suggests to us that even this more behavioral signal story did not work. Okay, so then we're going to think about this in very simple neoclassical terms, thinking, okay, we can model these as people just simply applying whenever their perceived expected benefit from making this application is greater than the cost. This expected benefit is going to depend on 2 things, on your quality and on the threshold that your quality needs to meet in order to get the job. Okay? And the way we're going to model this is saying, well, there is some threshold there that you know you have to meet, but you're not really sure whether you're going to meet this threshold or not. Now, this threshold we're going to treat as a fixed parameter, and this is not the A that actually gives you the job. We could calculate it. We know every applicant pool. We're going to treat it as a fixed parameter. We're going to structurally estimate, Because we want to model overconfidence, one. And secondly, and now this is Barbara's point, because we want to model lack of strategic sophistication. So, in theory, people should have responded to these interventions by updating the probability of getting the job. We ask them, what do you think is the probability of getting the job? And decreasing it, because now it's a more competitive field. But we don't see them doing that. So the probability stays fixed across treatments. And in the behavioral test, in fact, people show lack of strategic sophistication. There is a test, the beauty contest game, to identify that. So we believe that that is a specific feature of this context. It should have happened in a perfect world, but it didn't. Okay? Now, this probability is then multiplied by the net present value of getting the job, which we calculate by using a post-Lasso forecast of your market wage. So there is a section in the paper where I explain how we calculate this, and this has to be greater than the cost of the application that, as I said before, we expect to be heterogeneous, because the actual cost of paying the same bus fare or the opportunity cost of your time are going to differ across people. That's a very simple framework. Now, we're going to make two assumptions to make empirical progress on this framework. We're going to assume the B is discrete, and what I'm going to present you today, there are going to be just two values, low B and high B, low net present value of getting the job and high value of getting the job. And we're going to assume, this is a parametric assumption, that within each B bin, you're going to have a normal bivariate normal distribution regulating the relationship between costs and quality. So there are going to be mean of quality and mean of cost, there are standard deviations, and then this crucial correlation parameter for each B bin. So divide both sides of that inequality by B. You get a very simple condition that you apply whenever the probability of getting the job is greater than the cost-benefit ratio. This we can represent graphically, and already gives you the intuition that the solution to this very simple decision problem is going to be a cutoff point. In the paper, we show analytically that it exists and is unique. So everybody who's to the left of this cutoff point applies, and everybody to the right of this cutoff point does not apply. Okay, you got your cost-benefit ratio going up with cost, and you got your probability of getting the job. That in this case is going up with cost, because I'm assuming that this correlation is positive. It could have been flat or downward sloping. So what our interventions are going to do is simply shock that cost-benefit ratio, resulting in a new cutoff point, attracting a new bunch of people from C-star to C-star prime. And these are high-cost people compared to what we had before. And so the correlation is entirely going to determine whether these guys are going to be high-quality or low-quality compared to my control group of applicants. Okay, now let me see exactly how much. I'm going to take one more minute, given that I already got a few questions, to tell you about how, it'll be very brief, but we can talk about it in a coffee break or maybe not over dinner because it's not so interesting, but we're going to want to identify 13 structural parameters. There are 5 parameters for the bivariate normal, and 10 because we have 2 bivariate normals, one for the low B and one for the high B. We're going to want to estimate A, so this cutoff, and we're going to want to estimate the size of the shock, so 13 parameters. Now, what my framework suggests is that what I observe for control group individuals is a truncated distribution of applicant quality, truncated at a point of a correlated distribution of cost. Okay. Now, I observe the moments of the truncated distribution. I observe mean quality and the standard deviation of quality in the control group. That's a truncated distribution. And I observe the application rate in the control group, which gives me information about the point of truncation. And I can thus recover from these moments the moments of the original marginal untruncated distribution. Once I know that, I then start looking at the exogenous variation. So, first of all, the exogenous variation in terms of the number of applicants, well, this is very clear from this picture. This is going to depend on the size of the shock and on the density and on the variance or standard deviation of the C distribution, because that tells me how many people there are between C star and C star prime once I know by how far to the right I've moved. So I'm going to use the change in the number of applicants to identify the variance of C and the size of the shocks. And finally, as I've argued before, I'm going to use the change in quality to identify the correlation. Okay, this exercise, I use, this is a classical thing, so I'm going to then take my 14 empirical moments, have 13 theoretical parameters, I make a guess, I calculate a loss function, and I keep updating my guess until I minimize my loss function. That's what I'm going to do. And this exercise is going to result in a set of simulated moments that is actually extremely close, so we can fit extremely well all the moments that we are targeting, and we can also fit reasonably well the moments that we are not targeting, such as people's expectation of the probability of getting the job. So that was our crucial test for the model working, this non-targeted model. It's not perfect, but it's more or less in the right ballpark, okay, suggesting high overconfidence. Yes?
Just going to that figure, I mean, just that's why I asked my question before, because, I mean, the figure makes clear that B seems to be independent of treatment, that yep. The treatments vary C, so the net present value of the job is the same across treatments.
Well, B changes when you change the wage, but
that's it, there's no interaction between ability and wages or the net present value of the job.
So this is all about the correlation between B and quality, right? So you could imagine that B changes for a number of reasons, one of which is going to be quality to the extent the firms can observe quality. It could also be things that are, for example, seniority or experience in the labor market, which is slightly different from this idea of raw quality that we're talking about here. So you could have a low quality guy that has high B in the sense, okay, I'm somebody who's been 10 years in the labor market and not very smart. I still know that I have a high expected wage because when somebody sees my CV after 10 years of experience, I'm going to get a good salary for that. But yes. Let's say, good. Now, that's it. This is my penultimate slide. So these are the estimates. This is the mean of cost that we can get through this exercise in units of local currency, so between 150 and 200. The subsidy or the incentive in units of local currency was about 100, so about half of the cost for high B and two-thirds for the low B. This is highly heterogeneous, and as I said, strongly correlated with applicant quality. And unfortunately, in fact, I'm going to show you the picture. And this is really due to the selection story, at least that's what we propose in the paper. That's from that high-frequency survey that I mentioned at the beginning. You can see starting from fortnight zero until the end of the year, this is splitting in high-saving and low-saving types, and this is the average revenue score among people who are searching at that particular point in time. You start that they both have the same score. There is really no trend in the low-saving group, and there is a downward trend in the high-saving group among the rich type, so that by the end of the period, there is actually a large gap, entirely driven by selection. Okay, so that's really the story that we believe is behind. Oh, this was, I'm completely lost, but yeah. This is really what we believe is behind this positive correlation. Let me conclude. In this paper, we ran a worker recruitment experiment in Addis Abeba. We ran a second experiment with firm managers to assess whether they knew they could forecast the effects of this intervention. They couldn't. We estimated a structural model to quantify these structural parameters that were driving these somewhat surprising results from our application incentive intervention, and we provided evidence on this key mechanism using this high-frequency survey. Our key finding is that offering a monetary incentive, paying people literally to apply for a job, actually resulted in a higher quality pool of applicants for this employer. Why is this important? Well, we think this is important in particular because it suggests that there is a large number or a sizable number of talented but poor and sensitive job seekers who are struggling to place their talent on the market but that would generate high value for firms. And this is an important implication for how firms should design their hiring policies and governments should design their active labor market policies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We started a little late, so we still have time for some additional comments. Please.
One question is about kind of equilibrium effects. So in your experimental condition, there's only one firm offering these incentives, and you observe these great effects for the firm. If you have all firms offering the same incentives, basically the firm does not internalize any of the benefits because you just, overall, you're subsidizing higher intensity search, but none of the firms actually benefit from them because all the firms are offering the incentives, so they're all equally good. They don't get any competitive advantages. So as a, it can be kind of a private it can be a policy and equilibrium that I think that could be implemented by the firms. So could you think about some policy analysis given your structural models about basically if you wanted to encourage job search among these kind of poor, high-skilled workers, you wouldn't probably expect firms to do it in equilibrium. So you'd have to do it through some other mechanism.
Very important point, and this is a point that gets discussed quite a bit when I present this paper. So the structural model is in partial equilibrium, and part of it is it's a very simple model, and part of the spirit is that we want to restrict ourselves to things that we then can only use. Okay, we can only estimate. We can estimate just using exogenous variation. So we didn't really want to go the full-blown general equilibrium stuff. But what I can say is that there is a lot of evidence of labor markets where this is actually an equilibrium. One of them we know very well, and that would be the academic job market, where in the part of the application process where there is actually high application cost, the flyout, the equilibrium is full reimbursement. And you could imagine that no university would want to risk losing out on a good candidate. So people are arriving at the end of the PhD, they're at the most credit constraint. If you get 20 flyouts, you may actually physically not have the money to fly to 15 different countries to make those applications. So there are markets where this is actually an equilibrium. In Germany, it's very common, and at some point it became mandated by law, the firms had to do it. So yes, it may be that at that point for the firm there wouldn't be any more obvious gain. There would be a gain, there would be a loss if they stopped doing it because they would lose candidates. The main implication, if you just follow the reasoning, is more heuristic rather than model-based, would be that that pool of misallocated poor talented candidates would be reabsorbed, and that would be a good thing.
One more question?